Juno Afternoon is made possible with support from Sentinel Coffee, serving Southeast with locally roasted organic coffee and door-to-door delivery. More at sentinelcoffee.com. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and my guests today are both here representing Pillars of America. Welcome Mandy Massey and Tony Hoffman. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thanks for being here today. Mandy, let's start with you. Would you please tell us a bit about Pillars of America and what's your role there?
You bet. I'm a member of Glacier Valley Rotary Club here in Juneau, and I'm just a small part of the team that volunteers to put Pillars of America speaker series on. This is the 27th anniversary. We typically have three speakers come up and speak three Wednesdays in a row over here at Centennial Hall. And we are in our second week this year. Tony.
That's fantastic. And congratulations on 27 years.
Thank you so much.
Tony Hoffman, it's an honor to be speaking with you today.
Thanks.
I'm excited to share some of your story with our listeners today. We'll definitely hold some back for your talk. But let's start off by talking about your career. You're a BMX Elite Pro. What does that mean for our listeners who aren't familiar with BMX?
Well, I will say former Elite Pro. I haven't raced in quite some time now, but BMX is a niche sport. The average person makes about $10,000 to $15,000 a year in our sport, so there's no million-dollar contracts. We have the Olympics. We are in the Olympics and have been since 2008, so there are Olympic opportunities in which athletes can become very successful through the Olympic route, but we are... Imagine a 100-meter dash sprinter and put us on a bike, add jumps, corners, and rubbing, because we can rub in our sport. There's no lanes, and that's kind of what a BMX race is. 30 seconds, all-out sprint, average speed of about 26 to 28 miles an hour, 0 to 30 miles an hour in about 2 seconds. The average elite racer can produce the same torque as a Formula One car for 1 second.
Whoa.
Our legs are extremely strong. So, yeah, it's an extreme sport or an action sport. So when you hit the ground, you get injured. So, you know, you would see guys doing tricks and stuff. Those guys probably get injured less than we do, just because their environment's so much more controlled than, it's, say, a BMX race. When the gate drops in a BMX race, you have 30 seconds of all-out racing where everybody's making decisions on their own, and those decisions at times get in front of your decisions and cause you to crash at high speeds. And so there's a lot of risk for injury, like any other sport, but maybe just a little bit more for BMX. And so that's kind of what a BMX race is. You got a circuit that goes from January to November. It's a year-round sport that doesn't seem to have an off-season, and it's a worldwide sport. So you can go to almost every country in the world, and there's a BMX racing program somewhere.
What about Alaska?
There is an Alaska program, I believe, somewhere in Anchorage. I believe awesome. There's a track in Anchorage, yeah.
I just wanted to go back and follow up on rubbing. Does that mean you bump the other person?
Yeah, absolutely.
Beside you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that sounds dangerous.
Elbows, hips, you know, over jumps in corners. Positioning is extremely important. And so, you know, you might take football, for instance. You know, when the snap takes, there's, you know, offensive linemen that have jobs of creating holes and blocking and using their bodies. We kind of do the same thing, maybe not as extreme as football. But if you watch the BMX race, there is a lot of rubbing and moving around with their bodies at high speeds on a bike, which is nuts.
Yeah, it sounds wild.
Yeah, it is.
Well, you said you haven't raced in a while, but you did place second at the 2016 World Championships that were held in Colombia in the Masters Pro class. And you were a coach in the Rio Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. And you have even given a real TED Talk. So those are all some remarkable accomplishments. But there is more to your story. You had to overcome quite a lot to be where you are today. So could you tell us about maybe some of the setbacks you experienced early in your life?
Sure. So the accomplishments that you all listed have been done in, I would say, my new life. My new life started on January 21st, 2007. I was sentenced to 4.5 years in prison 30 days after January 21st, 2007. I suffer from a substance use disorder. Some would say drug addict would be a term. I'm a drug addict. I've been clean for almost 12 years now, but I started in high school smoking weed and drinking. And those activities, unfortunately for me, led me down to more dangerous drugs, substances, which led me to prescription painkillers. And when I got introduced to prescription painkillers, that actually became my drug of choice, which over time led to abuse of heroin, was on heavy amounts of cocaine and methamphetamine, and, you know, drove me to a home invasion robbery when I was 21 years old. It didn't stop there. I was given an opportunity to not have to go to prison and reform my life, but I couldn't reform my life. There was a lot of things I didn't understand about addiction, things that I was going to have to change in my life as a result to make me saying I'm never going to use drugs again actual reality. And so I wasn't able to change when I was given an opportunity to not go to prison and change my life. And over the course of the next 2 years is when I became homeless, heroin addict, methamphetamine addict, cocaine addict. And, you know, just the darkest moments that a person can think of. And so, you know, I've had to overcome those, and I continue to overcome those one day at a time.
And substance abuse, addiction, especially to painkillers, to opiates, are, of course, a major epidemic affecting our whole nation, our youth today. For you, this began more than 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, how did it start for you, and then how did it get out of control?
Well, the one thing I do want to say is that the average overdose age for the opioid epidemic is 35 to 55. This isn't actually a problem with our youth. It's a problem with our adults. And we won't go too far into that and why it's the adult age. But I do want to make sure that we clarify the opioid overdose death is 35 to 55 years old. Repeating your question before, what was your... You had some other questions. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just wondering, like, how did it start for you? I know you work with a lot of people on their recovery and prevention of a problem in the first place.
So a lot of the early indicators for me were mental health related, and they are for a lot of other drug addicts. Now, that doesn't mean that every drug addict or alcoholic suffers from high levels of mental health disorders. I had a lot of anxiety. Social anxiety is something I still deal with, and depression and suicidal thoughts, starting when I was about 11 or 12 years old. And those symptoms or problems that I was having were untreated, mainly because mental health wasn't a discussion in the mid-90s, and we also didn't understand how to deal with mental health. And so there were no therapeutic avenues, there was no counseling avenues. And so as those issues furthered in untreatment, you know, I found substances to fix those, which weren't really fixes. They were temporary fixes. When I tried them, smoking weed and drinking, it seemed to fill those voids. But when I came into contact with opioids for the first time, I'll never forget the first time I tried it, immediately my anxiety disappeared, my depression disappeared. I didn't want to kill myself anymore. I had no problems at parties, talking to people, and feeling like this is the way I've always wanted to feel. And so immediately, there was a gravitational pull towards opioid medication because it was, in my mind, doing what the doctors couldn't do for me, doing what the world wasn't able to provide for me, and that was me feel secure within myself. The problem is that I didn't understand addiction. I didn't understand that I had addiction or alcoholism in my family, and as a result of that, there was a gene in my family. And that I wasn't going to be able to control my substance use problems. And also, I didn't understand that the stuff that came out of the orange bottle was the same stuff that came from the cartel. It was just packaged different. Mm. And so this whole time I'm using these OxyContin pills or Vicodin, Percocet, I didn't understand that I was taking pharmaceutical heroin. This whole time I'm taking pharmaceutical heroin, I'm telling myself, well, I would never let it become as bad as this guy on the street.
Right.
They just lack willpower. You know, those guys are choosing for their life to be like that. I'm not going to choose that. And I'm stronger than that. My parents make six figures. I come from the good side of town. I'm an athlete. I have all of these things that doesn't happen to. But it does happen to, because you don't get to choose whether or not you're going to be an addict. And when you are an addict, there is only three things that happen: jails, institutions, and death. It doesn't matter who you are. You're going to one of those places. And for me, when I first got introduced to it, I was 18 years old. I wanted to kill myself. I had social anxiety. I didn't know how to make friends. I felt completely isolated and separated from everybody else, and I didn't know how to break that fear down to create friendships and create relationships that I felt secure in, and the drugs promised me that.
It sounds like right from the start, there was a lack of education, lack of information for you. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like that's better today?
Sure. I think it's absolutely better. I think we're still struggling on how to communicate that to youth. I think that the reason I have been so successful as a speaker is because I am doing it differently than what most governments, law enforcement agencies, or healthcare groups can muster up in a private room. Let's give the kids this. Let's give the kids that. Let's give the kids this. And not in a disrespectful way, but if you're 60 years old and you're trying to create drug policy or drug programs for youth, you are absolutely the wrong person to be doing it. I don't care if you hold a degree from Harvard. I don't care if you graduated from Stanford Law or you've been studying addiction for the last 25 years. Again, no offense to the people that hold those positions, but you don't know what you're talking about. We're talking about a new kind of youth. They engage differently. They've never seen a rotary phone. They've never seen a CRT television. They know social media. They know likes. They know shares. They know communication over technology. Our education system is still completely wrong when it comes to youth of today. I don't bring in a don't do drugs speech. I don't bring statistics. I bring a life story. And my life story is a person who was extremely successful as an athlete. But because he has addiction in his family, he found out that when he used substances, it was different than when somebody else that's not an addict used substances. What I'm trying to do is teach people that, you know what, some of us are addicts and that's okay. But when we are an addict, we have to take different steps in our lives for us to have a manageable life. And so kids don't feel like I'm telling them not to use drugs, because I'm not. I'm there to tell them about addiction, how it really works, and how it affects people's lives. I'm there to increase compassion, to increase empathy for those who are struggling with addiction, because the stigma is so high for people that are above 40 years old, right? Gen X, I would say, is where it starts. They're lazy, they chose that, they lack willpower. Before that, when we get to start getting into millennials, then we start seeing, well, we need to ask ourselves what happened. Why is that person struggling? You know what I'm saying? And so creating that, my speech is creating a bridge where I can break those stigmas down and educate people and have pass on more compassion and more empathy so we can actually reduce what's happening in our country right now. Find people the resources that they need, get them the help that they need so that they can get off the substances that they're using.
I like the honesty of your approach. And of course, now you have dedicated much of your life to recovery and addiction. You've talked about how you you give presentations and you speak. There are some other efforts that you're focusing on now. You're the founder and director of the Free Will Project. Would you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so I started a nonprofit organization in 2012 called the Free Will Project. I started the work of the Free Will Project in 2011. And the idea of the Free Will Project was to provide action sports opportunities, which was my gift, action sports, to at-risk kids in Southeast Fresno, which Southeast Fresno, I tell people, has the poorest zip code in the United States. We have an extreme level of poverty. A lot of that is due to our high influx of immigrant field workers that come to work the farms from where I'm from. 30% of the world's produce is grown in a 150-mile radius around my house.
Wow.
So you can imagine the influx of immigrant field workers that we have, but they also bring with them poverty, which isn't a bad thing, but it can make neighborhoods extremely tough to grow up in when nobody's making more than $10,000 to $15,000 a year. Kids don't go to school. Kids get involved in gangs. Kids get involved in drug sales and these kinds of things that deteriorate communities. And so what I wanted to do was bring an opportunity to these students, BMX and skateboard programs, that worked with them on their academics, on their character leadership qualities, their community service that they did within their communities, giving back, and obviously teaching them how to ride a bike or skateboard. And so that's what we did. We started in 2012 with summer camps, and we developed a school portion, a finance, personal finance portion. We partner with banks, and the banks teach them how to spend, save, and share portions of their money, because the goal at the end, after they do the track, they rotate through those three segments for the course of a summer, 8 weeks. And at the end, they've earned enough money to buy a bicycle from us. So a lot of people, adults would say, well, they give our kids bicycles. Yes, we do. But actually, we teach kids how to earn them. And we pay them checks, just like a normal adult earns a check. And at the end of the program, they have saved enough money to get a big check. And they take the big check to the bike store and they buy a bike from us. The kids don't know that we're actually giving it to them, because I'm teaching them real life. Again, another approach to how do you teach kids to live everyday lives? We don't teach statistics. We don't teach fear tactics. We just put them through real life. And we teach them, this is what real life looks like. You go to school, you got to show up. You go, you get a paycheck, and you got to save some of it, you got to spend some of it, and you got to donate some of it. And at the end, after you've gone through all of these things, your hands have the opportunity to purchase something with your own dignity that you want, which is the bicycle. And so started with the summer camp, then we developed an after-school program, which was very successful for many years. Our program is now on hold because I spend about 200 days a year on the road as a speaker. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we had kids with 0.7 GPAs that would, you know, finish the program 6 months later with 3.0s.
Wow.
Keeping kids out of gangs. You know, the area we're in is very, very high with Fresno Bulldog gangs. And so, you know, we're putting kids in parks and keeping them out of the neighborhoods that are bringing them down.
And tell us about your podcast, One Choice.
Yeah, so the podcast was kind of the answer to the hundreds of questions I get from students and people around the world on Instagram, you know, many asking how they deal with anxiety, suicidal thoughts, depression, how I've become successful. And, you know, I answer every one of those questions. It takes a while, you know, but I try to answer 10 a day. To each of these questions that I get, but I created a podcast that really addresses a lot of those questions because it's really hard for me to manage my time and give everybody this emotional, well thought out answer. Now I have a podcast episode that addresses most of the questions that I get, and I can say, you know, I want you to listen to my podcast episode, this one. Sometimes people ask me about relationships, breakups of relationships. Well, I have a podcast, Healing from Heartbreak. Go watch or go listen to this episode. And so it's really trying to expand my reach, but also, you know, up my effectiveness when it comes to being able to personally help one person that has an issue by creating an episode for them specifically, which is obviously not just for them. It's for the thousands of people that have the same question as they do. So weekly, I drop an episode Wednesdays. I've missed the last 2 weeks. I've been on the road quite a bit. But, you know, I have a Trading War Stories segment, which is kind of the entertainment recovery aspect. I talk about all of the crazy stories that, you know, I've experienced. And then I have my motivational segments, which are called The Truth. It's just myself, 10 to 20 minutes long. And it really hammers out how I went from a prison cell to the Olympics. Every piece of mindset that I've had to change, every quality that I've developed to become a successful person. And I speak directly on those for 10 to 20 minutes to try and motivate my listeners to adopt some of these qualities that I've had to take on to become successful, to get the best out of and most out of their lives.
Well, first I want to say congratulations on being 12 years clean.
And almost. May 17th, 2007.
All right.
So I can't claim it yet. When I get there, I'll claim it.
11 and like 95%.
Yes. Yes.
And it's amazing. I bet. When you look back on those 12 years and think about all that you accomplished in that time, being clean and drug-free versus like all that came before. It's a lot for anyone, but especially a lot for a single person to do in just 12 years.
Thank you.
Tomorrow you're going to be the featured speaker at the Next Pillars of America event. Mandy, can you give us the details about that and how we get tickets?
Absolutely. And I want to speak about who should be coming. Everybody should be coming, not just the youth, but adults alike. As Tony mentioned, this is an issue that affects us all, no matter what age. So bring your coworkers, bring your friends, bring kids age middle school, high school, and you can get your tickets today at Hearthside Books, either location, or at the door tomorrow at Centennial Hall. But I will say, get there early. It's a business luncheon. You'll be served a fabulous meal by a hangar on the wharf, and you know, you'll be inspired. It's a moment where people have an opportunity to feel changed, feel refocused, and kind of pivot their life and get inspired to move in the right direction.
I agree wholeheartedly. You know, we talk a lot about these days mindfulness and a lot of work you have to do for yourself, and it seems like a lot, you know, whatever you're trying to overcome. But, you know, there are ways to make it easier. There are ways to take the edge off. And I love hearing as much as I can about that sort of thing.
Absolutely. And I will say that the Juneau Glacier Valley Rotary does fundraise for this all year to bring this as a gift to Juneau. So, yes, the tickets are $35, but this is not a money-making opportunity for us. We really are trying to give back to the community to have these opportunities to speak with people like Tony.
And Tony, where can we find out more about you and your work? You have some websites?
Yeah, I do. So my speaking website is my main place to contact me nowadays. It's TonyHoffmanSpeaking.com. I have my BMX coaching website, TeamTHoff.com, and my Free Wheel Project website is FreeWheelProject.org. You can also find me on Instagram at Tony M. Hoffman, on Facebook, Tony Hoffman Speaking. My podcast, Tony Hoffman or One Choice, on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Podcasts app. Those are the avenues that you can find me at.
Very robust online presence.
Yes, I have to be.
And Mandy, how about Pillars of America? Is there a website for you guys?
Yes.
Somewhere
you
can find more info?
Absolutely. Juneau Glacier Valley Rotary, and you can find us on Facebook as well.
Just two?
Yeah. You know, there is a brand new Instagram one. So Glacier Valley Rotary on Instagram. We just, with Bacon Fest, we had to light that up. So you can find us there too.
I'm just teasing you. We can't all have five or six websites and social media accounts. Tony, Mandy, thanks so much for being here today. Tony, it was great to hear from you. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us, with our listeners today. And please go out to see him speak. That's tomorrow evening, Centennial Hall. What time is that?
Tomorrow, actually, doors open at 11:15.
11:15. Mm-hmm. Sorry, not in the evening. That's okay. It's a lunch hour.
Absolutely.
All right, 11:15 tomorrow, April 24th at Centennial Hall. Thank you both so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.